So tonight I'm going to talk about, I said, stress and difficulties and how we face those in our lives and in our sitting for that matter. And the word that's referring to is dukkha, which is a Pali word, the language the Buddha used. Which gets translated many different ways, often as suffering or unsatisfactoriness or stress is another way to translate. None of the words really capture the entire essence of the word, so you'll find a lot of people just use the word dukkha when they're talking. And it's one of my favorite things to talk about in this area. And the reason is there's, I think, a lot of misunderstanding about dukkha and what the Buddha said about it. Some people, you know, I talk to at gatherings here and there where, you know, it's just sort of regular people that don't have a meditation practice or, you know, they'll mention Buddhism. Oh, that's all about suffering, isn't it? Aren't you supposed to suffer a lot? And you talk about how much there's suffering in the world, and it's a bit of a downer, isn't it? I'd prefer to have a more happy and sing carols and songs and kind of spiritual tradition. And I hear that, you know, and I guess, you know, you could see it that way. There is in a way, we do talk about suffering, but we talk about how suffering is part of being human. I think the way the Buddha saw it was the alternative is, you know, you stick your head in the sand and hope for the best, you know, or distract yourself from being human in some way, whether that be drugs, alcohol, TV, working, eating, you know, there's so many ways we can distract ourselves from the reality of being human. And I think all the Buddha says is, you know, this human existence is precious, mysterious, it's joyful, it's great, but part of it is also, you know, there's illness, old age, sickness, and death as part of being human. So you know, until you kind of get that and face that, you're going to suffer a lot more than if you kind of realize that this is part of being human. You get the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. It's kind of part of the package. You can't have one without the other, even though we'd all like to just have the joy part and you can keep the sorrow part. So that's what when the Buddha talks about dukkha and suffering, that's really what he's talked. I mean, it's one of the three marks of existence in the sutras, there's suffering to be human. There's suffering, things change, and selflessness. It's the first noble truth. The four noble truths are kind of, you know, in many ways the cornerstone teaching, I think, for the Buddha. And this is the first noble truth is understanding and penetrating the reality, knowing the reality of suffering. There's a, I don't know if people have come across this. It's meditation hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife. Kim Boykin and her husband spent a summer at a cabin in Grand Lake, Colorado, the edge of the Rocky Mountain Park. And one day she picked up a pamphlet on living in bear country and the suggestions on what to do if you meet a bear. And to her, it sounded like meditation instructions. So she substituted the word thought wherever it said bear. And it's actually, I found it quite humorous. So here's some hints from the Colorado Division of Wildlife on how to meditate. Colorado has been home to thoughts since their earliest ancestors evolved in North America. Today, increasing numbers of people routinely live and play in thought country. Learning about thoughts and being aware of their habits will help you fully appreciate these unique animals and the habitat in which they live. What to do if you meet a thought, which we meet in our meditation time and time again. There are definite rules about what to do if you meet a thought. Thought attacks are rare compared to the number of close encounters. However, if you do meet a thought before it has time to leave your area, here are some suggestions. Remember, every situation is different with respect to the thought, its activity, the terrain, and the person involved. First of all, stay calm. If you see a thought and it hasn't seen you, calmly leave the area. Stop. Back away slowly while facing the thought. Give the thought plenty of room to escape. Wild thoughts rarely attack people unless they feel threatened or provoked. Speak softly. This may reassure the thought that no harm is meant to it. Relax. If a thought stands upright or moves closer, it may be trying to detect your scent. This isn't a sign of aggression. Once a thought identifies you, it may leave the area or try to intimidate you by charging to within a few feet before it withdraws. And don't run or make any sudden movements. Running is likely to prompt the thought to give chase, and you can't outrun a thought. If you have a potentially life-threatening situation with a thought, or an injury does occur, please contact the Division of Wildlife Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. So that, I thought that was kind of, I thought it was hilarious when I first heard that. Because that's what, I mean, our thought created reality is really what we sometimes, we often live in. We do all these things, this is really part of it, stay calm and stop and speak softly, so be compassionate with the thought that arises. And so if you leave the thoughts alone, then they'll just kind of leave you alone. But if we engage with the thoughts, of course, they can cause all kinds of problems. And we can get storms of thoughts, thoughts of self-criticism and self-judgment that arises. So we can live in a thought-created reality. And what the Buddha really talked about was living in a sense-based reality as opposed to the thought-based reality that we construct in our minds. So thoughts love to make up stories. Don't know if you've noticed that when you're sitting, how the mind can just make up stories based on partial information. So-and-so doesn't like me. And, it turns out, they never did. They never dislike the mind just creates all this, and it likes to do it on partial information too, because it's easier to just kind of grab something and construct a little story. And you can live in this thought created world. And of course, there's thoughts are at the center of dukkha. Thoughts are at the center. That's why I read that, even though the topic is stress or suffering or unsatisfactoriness. Thoughts are really at the center of this, of dukkha. And dukkha has nothing to do with aversion or any connotation of bad. So when people even say, "Oh, I'm having a dukkha." I've heard the expression, "I'm having a dukkha day." Well, and that's kind of using the term in a connection to it being I'm having a bad day. And really, it's not. This is not the intention for what the term was. It's not what the term intended. And notice the mind to have that bias against stress. Difficulties in our lives, that there is this, this is bad, I have to get rid of it somehow. And I'll talk some more about this. the Buddha said, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved or not getting what you want is dukkha. Getting too much of what you want is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. And that the aggregates is a whole other talk, but it's how we construct our kind of ego center. And the way in which we do that also creates suffering or dukkha. So, and as I said, there's no real one translation. As soon as you think you found the translation for dukkha, it's always deeper and more subtler than that. And you'll see it as I kind of go into this. The origin of all dukkha is craving. If you can understand that, and not understand it only intellectually, but understand it viscerally or from noticing it in your experience, then, you've really captured the Four Noble Truths. So you're well on your way to enlightenment. So in this practice, whether you're a Buddhist meditator or, practicing for health reasons, or you're just coming at this for because you find meditation relaxing and enjoyable, what you'll discover is that meditation isn't meant to protect you from experiencing difficulties or pain. I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, and I know there are a few other people here that teach it and have been through it, have taken the course. And so a lot of times people show up thinking, I'm going to take this 8-week meditation program and it's going to really get rid of my difficulties. It's going to get rid of my depression, or it's going to get rid of my anxiety, or get rid of my pain, physical pain. And you quickly, and people that are really sort of holding on to that idea often leave. After the first, this isn't what I signed up for. I thought this was like a cure, kind of going to help me. I don't want to relate to the pain. I want it to go away. What are you telling me? I have to relate to this. I just want it to go away. And that's one. That's not what the Buddha was talking about. It was not a way to protect us or get rid of the stress and difficulties in our lives. Because these are unavoidable parts of being human. They're unavoidable. The Buddha had back pain, all the walking he did. I did the Buddha pilgrimage, but we did it on an air-conditioned bus, and I thought, how did this guy walk from there to there to there to there? And into his fairly old age, he was, especially in that era, walking, and I think because of all the walking, he had back pain. So he suffered physical, he had grief, outward signs of grief when friends died. So there's no protection, even when you get that far into it, to enlightenment or awakening. So what it does enable you to do is relate to pain and stress in your life in a way that doesn't define you and without adding more stress or anguish to it. And that's so key. Your way of relating to it so that it doesn't define who you are and so that you don't add more to it. So you need, in many ways, the pain and stress that we suffer is what we grow from. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, no mud, no lotus. So you can get a t-shirt that says that now. If you Google no mud, any buttons, and bumper sticker. No mud, but it sums up this, no mud, no lotus. Well, the lotus flower needs the mud on the bottom in order to be a beautiful flower on the top of the marsh. And that's, our lives are like that as well. there's a way that we can respond to the stress and difficulties that we can still blossom. We can wake up and grow through it. I just heard Tara Brach refer to there's a movement or a group, instead of calling it post-traumatic stress syndrome, they're calling it post-traumatic growth syndrome, and looking at ways that this intense stress that's caused trauma can actually be turned into growth and a blossoming, because there's a lot of mud in something that traumatic, and how that can be kind of shifted. It's just looking at it in a different way and approaching it, the trauma, in a different way. So our craving, so stress plus reaction equals suffering. So you have the initial stress, then we react. That leads to more suffering. Stress plus presence equals evolution or growth. So being present with it in a new way can actually be a growth. So it's a critical shift. A shift in view. Now, one thing that really helped me understand this, both at a cognitive level as well as an experiential level, was the three types of dukkha. And I don't have people heard of the three types of dukkha. I couldn't believe how long I'd kind of been learning this stuff I came across probably in my 30s, and I've been, reading and looking at this, reading the Four Noble Truths and going to talks, and I didn't hear about the three kinds of dukkha. And when I heard it, all this stuff kind of fell together for me. And I don't know if it does for everybody, but often it's just kind of where we're at in that moment. Can I get you to do us a favor as you're walking by, ma'am? Can I get you to flick on the light? That'd be just great. I think it's right beside the fire extinguisher there. Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. It's getting too dark for me to see. Thank you. So the three kinds of dukkha. I'll just go through them one by one. There's dukkha. So this is the kind of dukkha that arises in response to an unpleasant physical or mental experience. An unpleasant, you stub your toe. That's dukkha. You burn your hand. You cut your finger. I just cut my finger, and it's healing, but it looks real. But that's just plain old, that's dukkha. It's intrinsic suffering, painful physical and mental feelings. When I had my concussions, which I've talked about, and I had headaches, that's dukkha. It's just this severe sort of head pain. And everybody's life includes this. It includes dukkha. It's unavoidable. So these things just happen as suffering occurs. It's part of being human. I'm just going to go through these before I get into sort of how we respond to them. The second type of dukkha, and I'm not sure I'm going to say this, viparinama dukkha. And that's basically referring to suffering based on change. So the first one is just, the pain grief that we experience as part of life. This one is, it refers to the impermanent nature of things. So whereas the first one's, you know, an unpleasant event, this is the impermanent nature of a pleasant event that causes suffering. And this is sometimes harder for people to get their heads around. A lot of times people think dukkha just refers to unpleasant stuff happening. You know, shit happens, here it is, this is dukkha. But it also arises with pleasant events. This is where the translation unsatisfactoriness, when you get that translation, it kind of captures this idea of how we suffer with pleasant events. We don't get enough of it. We keep being able to be with that pleasant event. So it arises in response to pleasant events, and it's tied to the impermanence or change. Viparinama means changing. So that beautiful sunset, we're enjoying it, but oh, now it's fading, it's going away, and there's just this. If you can tune into this, that sense, subtler sense, perhaps, than if you stub your toe, that subtler, deeper sense of suffering that comes around, arises with that. And again, the origin of it is craving. So the origin, you know, when we have pain and grief, what we crave for is to get rid of it. When we have a pleasant event, what we crave is to hold on to it. And it's the change of it, the impermanence of it. We can't hold on to it. And people will go to, you know, we crave for it to continue. People will go to extremes to capture and try to maintain a pleasant sensation. Drugs, overeating. I mean, there's many examples of, you know, we can go to real extremes to keep feeling the pleasant event, pleasant sensation. And this impermanent nature of all phenomena, everything ends, everything changes, leaves this craving unsatisfied. And there can be more craving and more craving. There can be an unease, an underlying unease or dissatisfaction, even when we're experiencing a joyful event. Because at some level, at some gut level, we know it's not going to last. For example, I enjoy sunsets. I love a good sunset. You know, if you follow me on Facebook at all, I don't know how many times you see like a sunset. I figure people must get sick of seeing sunset pictures. And I actually went through my you know, all my pictures, and there's just like sunset pictures. There's more pictures of sunsets than there are of my wife Vida. So, and I love her dearly, but I think sunsets are, you know, up there at a close second. So I love sunsets, and we have this new cottage, and I'll sit in the evening and look across, and the sun sets across the lake, so with trees, and I'll watch this sunset across the lake, and you know, the shimmering pinks and purples and everything shimmering on the water. Somehow watching a sunset across the water just makes it so much more spectacular. It's a spectacular beauty. And as I watched it, I kind of felt this underlying discontent. This wasn't going to last. You know, it happens fast this time of the year too. That's when I really noticed it was, because you know, it's not just kind of, the sun doesn't just kind of go down. It goes, and then it gets dark real quick, as we saw. I had to turn the lights on. So there's this. I noticed this really subtle underlying discontent arising around the sunset not lasting. So that, you know, that's part of why I take that, you know, that's the picture thing. I'm going to make this last forever. I'm going to take a picture of it. of course, all you have is a picture of a, you look at the picture, it's never the same as the actual, especially on an iPhone or something, right? It's never the same. And you know that intrinsically, you know that it's not going to be the same even if you take a picture of it. So we know this deeply. So as I said, that one's sometimes tricky for people to get. How can pleasant events cause suffering? But really look at that in your daily life. And sankhara dukkha is, it translates to suffering due to formations, mental formations. Sankhara refers to the intentional formation of thoughts, mental formations. So sankhara dukkha arises when we move beyond aversion to an unpleasant physical or mental experience, engage in physical, stressful mental activity, such as judging, stories about it, anxiety-filled thoughts. So we're adding another layer of suffering on top of the original suffering. And this is tremendous. And this is, often this is when we're talking about how we're responding to stress. This is really where we're getting into the crux of it, because we do this a lot. Often it's, an unpleasant event. Arises, and there's almost often an immediate kind of aversion to it, right? And then you can kind of notice that if you're being mindful in that moment. And just kind of go, okay, this is part of being human. Stuff happens. But often what we can do, why did I do that? Why, what stories about how could I be so stupid to do X, Y, and Z and not realize that this was going to cause an injury? Lots of swearing, perhaps, if it's, that kind of a stubbing of the toe or that kind of an injury. So these anxiety-filled judgments and stories add a whole layer of suffering to the original stuff. So that's sankhara dukkha. So for me, these three just capture so much. It captures it all. And the first two capture, just that, we're being human and we have, pleasant and unpleasant events occurring throughout our day, throughout our sittings. And the job of mindfulness, when we're being mindful, is to be as best we can with those as they're at a sensory level. Oh, there's pain in the knee, there's and of course we don't always do that. Sometimes, we react, which is fine too. It's not an opportunity to self-judge. We just, then we can bring mindfulness to the next moment. The next thing about mindfulness is you can kind of bring it in anywhere. You can bring it in after you've dropped five or six F-bombs or you can bring it in right at the event. And every gradient of it will happen. No longer how long you've been meditating. The odd time, mindfulness will just kick right in and you'll just, okay. There's an acceptance, the non-judging, no stories arising. Another time, a very similar thing could happen. You could go to all these reactions, a big story about it, and then you might notice. You've already gone into sankhara dukkha, but you bring mindfulness. Oh, here's sankhara dukkha, look at that. Wow, that mind was quick. It's like 30 seconds and that was a big story about how stupid I am. Or whatever, But you can notice it for what it is. There's sankhara dukkha. That's what we do. It's what the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, that's what people did. They had this three kinds of dukkha. So if you can bring in with sankhara dukkha, if you can bring these these mental formations or stories and judgments, anxiety-filled thoughts, into a conscious awareness, they can fade into nothing. As soon as you bring them into awareness, they fade. Have you ever noticed that? You bring a judgment or a story like that, hold it in awareness, and it fades. Because you can't hold it in awareness and feed it at the same time. I've actually sat and tried that. I'm going to hold it, and I'm going to try and let it keep going, and it won't. You cannot hold it in awareness and feed it at the same time. Give it juice, loses its juice. It's like you unplug it. The toaster's not going to keep toasting the toast once you unplug it. And bringing mindfulness to it, it's kind of like unplugging the toaster. There's no power, juice, or whatever going to the story. It's amazing actually to watch the stories kind of go brrr when you just bring awareness to it. So, as I said, mindfulness can be brought to anywhere along this continuum of reaction to storytelling, to, you know, deep sadness or whatever it might be. I mean, the story might go for a while before you notice. I mean, you could have a whole mood shift, and you go, "Oh, wow, this is what dukkha dukkha with sankhara dukkha layered on top feels like. Wow, this is. I can see why the Buddha talked about this on and on and on. This is really heavy." Or very tense, or however it feels in your body. That's time to just kind of go to the body and sort of tune into what this whole, you know, what this mess feels like at the body level. And as the power of mindfulness increases, and this is with practice, we're better able to shift our attention earlier on in the process. So you'll have insights into impermanence, insights into sort of the universal nature of stress and difficulties in our lives. So this can be kind of the first stage in letting go of craving or longing for our life to be different than what it is in that moment. That's really what we're always talking about. We're craving for things to be different than they are in that present moment, rather than being present with what's arising in that moment. I want things to be different. And that's a key. That's what craving really is wanting things to be different than they are. And if you've hung around these kind of talks long enough, you've heard that line many, many times. And I can never sort of hear it too many times, you know, because that's often what will arise. And I'm wanting things to be different than they are. That doesn't mean we don't organize ourselves to, you know, avoid difficulties. It just means that when they arise, we can just be present with them in that moment. And then your mind may go, "Oh, next time I should do X, Y, and Z." So when I got injured this finger, I was doing a chin-up. My son said, "Oh, you should do the wide stance because it'll build, the, you know, for my dragon boating." So we do these workouts. He said, "Oh, you should really..." So I did, but I couldn't do it wide. So I put these big elastic on the chin-up bar, and then... So then I couldn't get the elastic off. Lift up my foot, the elastic's still on there. So I let go with this hand, bring my hand down to take the elastic off my foot, and of course the whole machine tips over into another machine and it catches my finger. So there was pain, you know. Was it broken? Is it, you know, all those thoughts just go through your head. How am I going to do my, you know, work that I have to do and so on? All those thoughts kind of, you know, it starts to immediately go into stories. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not going to do that again, right? I'm not going to put the same elastic on my foot and do that kind of exercise. I'm going to avoid that injury. So that, you know, that was an experience of fairly intense pain, and watching the mind create stories around, you know, why did you do that? Nobody was home also, so that kind of, you know, you could have killed yourself. You know, then the doomsday scenarios arise. You know, you should know better at your age than to do. You're too old to be doing this type. You know, my 28-year-old son recommended this kind of thing. So those stories came, but they, you know, they came into awareness for the most part and lost their juice. So I was able to, you know, grab a towel and look after the injury. But that's, you know, a craving for things to be other than they are in that moment. That's what was my reality in that moment. That's what happened. No way around it. So, mindfulness can help us question the validity of the thoughts. You know, the validity of a thought arising. You know, the thought arose in that instance, I should have known that would happen. But that's not a valid thought. I had no idea that would happen. I had no idea this contraption could even tip over. But that's the thought that arose. So holding that in mind, it's just like, yeah, no, I should not really have known that could happen. You know, is it fair that happens? That's another thing. You know, if we have a physical injury, well, this isn't fair. Why me? Why did this have to happen to me? Or why, especially at this time, and so on and so forth. So learning to kind of question the credibility of these mental formation or these anxiety-filled thoughts can really free us from these thought patterns that perpetuate suffering. As I said at the very beginning, is the thoughts, and that's why, you know, the talking about the hints and dealing with, you know, bears, and so the way that we relate to thoughts is really key in how we relate to stress and difficulties in our lives. We live in this thought-based reality so much of the time. And you know, the Buddha even talked about cultivating more skillful mental states, practices for cultivating compassion and loving kindness, and sympathetic joy and equanimity. So there's a real emphasis on how we take care of our thoughts. And seeing how our thoughts shift what our lived experiences in our day into stress and suffering, into dukkha. Leave it at that and open it up to any questions. And to folks that are new, we have this little protocol, I guess you'd say. We do this before we speak, and then we do this when we finish. So that way you can kind of pause, and people know you still might say more until you indicate that you're finished. So any questions or comments about that talk or anything else that's come up.
just appreciated a lot of things you said, and I just wanted to add to when you were talking to about the sunset and the second kind of dukkha. I was reflecting with a colleague this week. We were talking about after the weekend, how we were feeling, and we were talking about the feeling kind of depressed thing, that summer is over, or almost over, going to end. So I feel this time of year, it's not like a sunset, it's more like a longer cycle kind of thing. I can feel this, or possibly can feel this time of year, that with the summer going and changing, things changing, that can be a bit depressing when we see summer.
Can people see those, that kind of dukkha arise even when they're practicing sitting meditation? The sitting meditation is just a laboratory for life. I mean, it's a controlled environment where you just basically get to see lived experience that you can kind of contain a little bit, right? But you see, it's the same as, it's just practice for living. So you see a pain arise somewhere in your body. Sometimes as soon as you sit down, oh, there's a cramp in my thigh or my calf or something. So then you've got dukkha right then and there. And maybe you just go, oh, there's a, pain arising in my calf. Just sit with the sensation for a while. So you sort of see how what it's like to just bring the dukkha into consciousness. Maybe it fades, or maybe it intensifies, and you have to move. Either way, you've just kind of been with the sensation. Or maybe what happens is that the sensation arises in the calf, and then you go, crap, we just sat down. If I move, people are going to think I'm a terrible meditator. Oh, I am a pretty why I've been sitting, I shouldn't sit this way. I should have sat on a chair. Whatever, the stories can arise in so many ways. Self-judgment, self-criticism, and so on and so forth. And you can watch that arise. And, maybe you go, oh, bring that into awareness and just kind of watch those stories. Or maybe they spin for a while before you bring it into awareness, and then you can kind of feel how that's kind of shifted your whole sitting. And you just bring that into awareness. So, I mean, really, that's what we're doing when we're sitting, is we're just watching experience unfold, watching life unfold, the same way we do when we're living it with each other out, out in the world. So I don't know, does anybody sort of relate to that when they're meditating?
I don't know whether it fits into one of the three categories, but it seems to me like a very, in my mind, but certainly a very important source of dukkha is this of self. The self to the idea of self, comparing the self to the father, and the inevitable consequence of that being separate. But what about through that category?
So many of those, I forget to do that sometimes. break my own protocol. So many of the stories that arise within sankhara, dukkha, revolve around egoic self. That's, you'll notice that with the stories. That's why there's often self-criticism, self-judgments. There's an egoic sense of self that's being protected and identified with in that sense. And it's the identification with those thoughts that then cause a sankhara. And you can get sankhara, you can get layer upon layer upon layer of suffering. Maybe I made it sound like there's like a layer of suffering, but you can layer these on. These can layer on quite thick, like a lasagna, you know, of suffering. And that's it. when you get really self-identified, you can really see suffering, you know, proliferate. Yeah.
I appreciated the way just, you know, certain words resonate sometimes, so the being human reminder, because I feel like I've grown a lot in becoming aware of my dukkha, sankhara, dukkha, but sometimes I think subconsciously I think it should all eventually go away. I'm okay, I know there's impermanence, and I know that there will be pain sometimes. I'm less compassionate or accepting of my thoughts that associate with those things. So just hearing the words, being human, I think will be my way of bringing back the awareness. So thank you.
You had started the talk with outsiders viewing Buddhism as depressing or feeling of suffering. And at the end of the talk, you had talked about a few things like compassion and sympathetic joy, which brought to mind my question, which maybe a little off to one side, but what would be the opposite of dukkha when you're feeling a good mood, when you sit down and feel very comfortable? You said you sit down feeling dukkha. If you sit down and feel very comfortable, is there an opposite feeling to dukkha?
That's that second kind of, even that comfortable feeling can causes dukkha. It's the pleasant, the impermanence of the pleasant, yeah, the impermanence of the pleasant, the craving for the pleasant. This is the one that people, I think, have the hardest time. You know, how can craving the pleasant cause suffering? But really, look at that in your life. Look at how when you crave comfort or crave sunsets, crave the summer, crave whatever it might be, material possession, whatever. It doesn't have to be, it can be anything. How there's a subtler, but just as real suffering, dukkha, that goes on. Stress might not be the word to use. That's why, you know, dukkha is so, you know, it's more of a dis-ease or an unsatisfactoriness or a bit of both, depending on how you're relating to the pleasant event. It's the opposite of when we think of dukkha as just suffering based on an unpleasant event. No, dukkha is suffering based on a pleasant event as well. So it's very important to hold that. And that's why the three types really helped me kind of pull this all together, because you got pleasant, you got unpleasant, you see how they both cause suffering, and then you've got the stories about them both that can then also cause suffering. So it kind of just brought it all, before it was kind of fragmented for me, and this kind of all brought it into, I have this conceptual brain. So at an intellectual level, I understand, and I know in meditation, mindfulness meditation, it's all about sensing things viscerally and the practice, right? But this brain sort of does that, but at some point, once it gets the conceptual model or whatever, it goes, oh, okay, and then it kind of backs away. It doesn't keep trying to figure it out. It just gets in the way of understanding, of knowing, like at a deep level. So it's really important, you know it at an intellectual level. Now just go out in the world and see, is this true to your experience? Does suffering arise, or dis-ease arise when you crave? It's craving. So it's not the unpleasant event that causes suffering. It's the craving behind it that causes the suffering. On all of these, it's all about the craving that's behind it that's causing the suffering. The craving to get rid of the unpleasant, rather than being present with it, the craving to have more of the present, the grasping for the pleasant, rather than just being present with it, being joyful with it. Of course, you can be joyful, you can be present. But underlying that is a knowing that it's impermanent. And that's okay. That's the way reality is. Yeah. So yeah, there isn't really an opposite. I mean, I guess if you're enlightened, if you know this at this deeper level, then you're constantly just being with experience, with life as it's unfolding. There's no you experiencing it. There's no, I mean, it's an unfolding. You have no control over. I guess that could be that's what the Buddha really talked about in the Four Noble Truths is penetrating. The cessation of suffering would be the opposite of the continuing of suffering. I hope that answers the question.
I mean, you have other words for it, being in the zone or being in the moment. I was just wondering if there was a kind of term or anything that would reflect that notion of just enjoyment at the time, rather than thinking about the time and craving it. I'm thinking about being in the moment, having that enjoyment, it's not going to be enjoyable. I don't think that's a common word. So I'm just wondering if
like sukha,
that sort of section,
dukkha and sukha.
In terms of the terminology that might be penetration so much, or like movement, whatever.
Okay, so it would be sukha, which is the best translation for that awareness or presence. So that, in that sense, that would be could be considered an opposite state. Yeah.
I was just going to add with the word that maybe has been overused, but the English word slip, where there's that sense of nothingness and just everything is good. Like relaxation or joy or freedom.
Yeah, bliss that is without craving behind it, right? So it's the craving that would turn bliss into a form of dukkha.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but bliss just, and that's often what happens in our, it happened in my meditation practice where, I'd reach blissful states and I became attached and identified with them, and so then there was a suffering that arose as a result. For quite some time, it was my way of practicing and it's an addictive personality behind that as well. So there's a lot going on, but that there was a craving behind it, which then it led to, but, you know, bliss arising, being present with it, allowing, in meditation practice at least, can lead to deeper levels of bliss. And in our lives as well, just being present with something that's very joyful, I think, in my experience, brings the joy of it, kind of blossoms, so that, because that sense of dis-ease doesn't arise with it. So that it can really blossom. It can be fully experienced, just the way it is. Yeah. Mm. That's wonderful. So it's a mindful eating program. Yeah, that's wonderful. It's a great program. And I don't know anything. I did the mindfulness-based relapse prevention, which is teacher training, which is drugs and alcohol, which is, again, dealing with that precognitive urges. And we call it urge surfing, and just being able to... And I don't know if they use the same lingo in the mindfulness-based eating programs, but really just, and we're craving machines in a way. In the advertising and the messages we get is craving, you know, is to crave, and it's good, and you crave and you get, and you crave and you get, and so there's a lot of these subliminal, as you, precognitive urges that arise, whether it be for food. Drugs, alcohol, all kinds of things in society that that arise. So it's just urge surfing. So how to see that, how to see it arising at an earlier stage. Work, buy, consume, die.
Pretty powerful.
Yeah. Gross domestic product. Okay, well, thank you everyone for coming. It's again great to see you all, and hope to see you next week. I'll be here.